the Center Church podcast.
Hello, Center Church community, and glad to be with you for a third week, and very excited this week because I can introduce to you Pastors Brad and John, who are going to be with me in conversation, looking at Ecclesiastes chapter 10 this week. And in fact, it's the first seven verses of chapter 10, particularly chapter 10, verses 2-7. So you won't be able to see them, but I'm looking at them, and we're doing this over Skype as we are looking at this text together, and hopefully you are able to be with roommates or spouses and be listening and in conversation as we are in conversation. John has positioned, just to paint the picture for you, John has positioned his webcam, as far as I can tell, in the far top corner of one of his rooms. So we're looking at John from a bird's eye view here. John,
yeah.
Do you want to comment on that?
I have a desktop computer set up that I'm operating from, whereas both of you, I'm assuming, are on laptops, and so it's getting a lot of flack here earlier before you guys joined us in the conversation, so you guys are getting to experience a little bit of my shame.
The headset is what really does it, though.
It's hard to tell how John feels about this because he's so far away. I can't tell if he finds it funny.
It's so funny.
Okay. Well, so those of you who have been with us through most of the Ecclesiastes journey are aware that there are a few places in Ecclesiastes where there are these really collections of wisdom sayings. The first one is in chapter 7. So the beginning of chapter 7 all the way into chapter 8, maybe the first half of chapter 8, is this collection of wisdom statements. And now, today, we're talking about, that's the first one that we see. And now today, we're talking about the second collection of wisdom statements that is essentially the first half or first seven verses of chapter 10. And so, I mean, there are commentators out there. There are scholars out there who try to observe connections between these wisdom teachings, and you can try to do that as well if you like, but I probably wouldn't waste my time. I feel like any attempt to draw these together is probably reading something into the text that isn't there. I think we have collections of wisdom statements, and so that's what we're going to be looking at today. So essentially, to map it for all of you that are listening in the community, John has some initial commentary to kind of lay the foundation of what we're looking at. And then we'll talk about this first wisdom statement, which is verses 2-3 primarily. And we'll each kind of have some observations and conversation around verses 2-3. And then we'll talk about the second wisdom statement, that is verses 4, 5, 6, and 7. And we'll have some commentary around that, assuming we can make it that far. And then we'll conclude for the discussion today. So, well, with that being said, John, you have some pretext for us to kind of set the stage, I think.
Yeah, I think a lot of people encounter wisdom text and collections like this, you know, the Proverbs, other smaller collections that are out there, and I think they can be taken for granted, kind of treated like fables, and they don't necessarily make the spiritual link. Lewis says that of Christianity in his book Mere Christianity, that one of the reasons why Christianity doesn't really need a special education in becoming a Christian is because it is an education in and of itself. It takes you where you are, and then it teaches you how to be in the faith. A lot of what we cover again today isn't going to be overtly spiritual. Some of these parables are simple wisdom that you've heard echoes of throughout your life, but they're part of that education in Christianity on how to live a right life, how to live a good life. And we have an obligation to learn and grow our lives and our faith. And there's, you see some of that place where our faith infects the other corners of our life and kind of breaks through that compartmentalization. I found in my life, and even in talking with other people, that one of the biggest sources of stumbling in our faith is often self-inflicted through engaging in some of this nonsense and drama that the Bible calls foolishness, which is the opposite of what the Bible sees as wisdom. Lewis also goes on to say in The Problem of Pain that nonsense, when you're still nonsense, even when you're talking about God. And so, again, carrying that through, foolishness, the opposite of wisdom, carries through and affects our faith life, even especially when we're not careful. So it's just more of looking at what wisdom is for us. It's more than just knowledge. It's more of just data of what is right, but it's an applied knowledge. And I think that's foundational for living a fulfilled life and having a thriving faith.
So we've talked about this a few times, and I know we've talked about it, and then in our community we've talked about it. So I'm reading from Robert Alter's translation, which I've referenced many times along the way, and suppose it warrants another one, which is to say, if you have a chance, he now has I think it's 3 volumes on the entire Hebrew Bible. So so he's translated now that the entire Old Testament. If you have a chance to ever read the Old Testament in his translation, I think it's preferred. So I don't know, with Brad offering us like that transition, I'll read, because I have the text in front of me here. I'll read chapter 10. This is verses 1-3 in Alter's translation, and we'll get into some commentary on that. Chapter 10, here we go. A dead fly makes the perfumer's oil chalice stink. I love that. That alone is worth it.
I want a chalice.
What's that?
I said I want a chalice.
You do. You want. We all want a perfumer's oil chalice, right? Yeah. Heavier than weighty wisdom is a bit of folly. A wise man's mind is at his right, and the fool's mind at his left. Even when the fool walks on the road, his mind is absent, and it says to all, he is a fool. So there's this opening wisdom statement. I'll read verses 2-3 again. A wise man's mind is at his right, and the fool's mind at his left. Even when the fool walks on the road, his mind is absent, and it says to all, he is a fool. So there's our first first wisdom statement to have some discussion on today.
Beautiful.
Yeah. John, do you want to offer any opening commentary on that one? Or
I still really appreciate, you know, the coming off of chapter 9, the encouragement that we got there, the imperative to go and do. I think a lot of people, when they're looking for direction in life, are looking for that super specific word from God on which loaf of bread to buy, which kind of milk to get in the house, what brand of car. And I think a lot of things the Lord leaves for you in personal discernment and your own agency involved with it. And I think that that's a really heady thing to be able to enjoy. And I see this opening into chapter 10 kind of being a little bit of weight to go with that, to caution one from just being cavalier with those decisions and sort of beginning this wisdom literature, these collections of axioms, I think are really great to kind of build some guidelines to make those decisions that we make in our lives, which, you know, aren't the spiritual decisions. And I think having some of that responsibility, particularly from, say, verse one, is a really good caution and weight when you're making the decisions you make in your life. And they flow to, I think, verses two and three to give us a little bit more of some of that trajectory of a series of decisions that have been made that make you foolish or a wise man, kind of put you on one of those paths, as opposed to like a singular action maybe isn't making you a fool, but you're making a series of those decisions. And I think that's sort of what we're looking at here when we're looking at the foolish man or the wise man, as the Bible paints a parallel or contrast between those two.
Yeah, it's definitely a transition. It's a beautifully phrased line. It's definitely a transition statement, and it's really as pragmatic as you could want. You can, as far as my reading of this, I mean, again, I don't know that it warrants. I think it's so clear. Heavier than weighty wisdom is a bit of folly. I mean, you can live a very wise. One can practice all kinds of pragmatic wisdom, live a very wise life by anybody's measure, and it doesn't take much folly to ruin it. Like, you can, across many metrics of one's life, you can be wise, and just a little bit of folly will take your life off course. And so it's a dark statement, but it's a true one, and it sets us up for verses 2 and 3, which is this idea that if the mind is absent, you're a fool.
Right. Like the person who salts their food before tasting it.
Right. Right.
I don't trust people who do that.
I feel like you're writing a collection of wisdom statements.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dusty.
No, if I ever interview you for a job and we get breakfast, do not salt your food until you taste it. Otherwise, the interview's over.
Yeah. It's over because this is somebody who is
a sociopath.
Yeah, no, it's over because it's someone who, you know, why are they salting their food before they taste it? Because they saw someone else do it. You know, they're not thinking for themselves. They're absent. But it is that going back to one, I don't know if maybe this is an interesting fact, but I find it interesting. Alter's comment on fermentation, how he says a fly would not make oil ferment. When I read that earlier, I was like, I know that's in his sub commentary of the deal, but it actually would, a fly. And a part of me wants to, that's like the first Alter statement that I've been like, I'm going to argue that one actually, but from a microbiological point of view, right? It only takes one small strain of bacteria to contaminate an entire batch of something. And so if that fly lands in your chalice per se, you know, and it's carrying something, some bacteria, some folly, that can quickly duplicate itself. You know, mitosis takes place and then boom, the whole batch is ruined from that one speck that came off of the fly. So why Alter said no fermentation, I don't know.
And he would respond. I think he's like,
what?
I think you could probably email him and he would respond. I think inaccessible in that way. You know? No,
this is Brad calling him out right now.
Yeah, right here on this podcast, sermon radio thing. Yes. When Alter listens to this, of course, because we know he'll call me up. Like, who was that guy?
As he waits eagerly for the episode to release, he's disappointed to find your critique of it. I think what you're saying is even more to the I think, I mean, unless I'm missing it, I didn't read that. I didn't.
It's in the sub. Go to the bottom of that page of the
footnotes in there somewhere.
Yeah, the footnotes of whatever page number is for the beginning of chapter 10.
But I actually, as far as I can tell, it kind of underscores the broader point, which is that's how little it takes.
Yeah.
How little folly it takes to ruin wisdom. So.
I mean, we see that everywhere in our culture, how easily, like, these titanic monolithic figures are brought down by, like, a singular action or a careless word.
Yeah, I think that my kind of sense, and it does serve to frame verses 2 and 3. My primary observation with 2 and 3, so for those who are listening and, you know, are still writing things down or are still kind of like, you know, organizing the conversation around any kind of essentially anchors or key points. To me, verses 2 and 3, it's all about the wise man demonstrating intellectual acuity. That was kind of the phrase I landed on after thinking a lot about, quite a bit about verses 2 and 3. There's this intellectual acuity or this sharpness of mind that the wise man demonstrates that the foolish man does not. In fact, so I'll bring this up now. I want to credit the people who do the work here. I think it was Fox's commentary where I read this. So if you guys are catching anything that I'm not referencing correctly, let me know. But Fox basically says, it's either Fox or Longman that tie together Ecclesiastes chapter 10, this wisdom statement in verses 2 and 3, to Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verses 21 through 25. So I'm actually going to rewind to verses 21 through 25 in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, because I think it helps us understand verses 2 and 3 here. I'm going to read that. It'll be short. Chapter 7, verse 21. Do not take to heart all the things that people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. Your heart knows that many times you yourself have cursed others. All this I have tested by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but it was far from me. That which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find it out? I turn my heart to know and search out and seek wisdom and the scheme of things, and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. So it's, I think what's interesting here is in chapter 10, we have this contrast between the wise person, the wise man, and the fool. And it really doesn't give us, it says that the fool goes to the left, the wise man goes to the right. It doesn't give us many details about the personality of the wise man, or the character traits of the wise man, nor does it give us much about the character traits of the fool. But in its kind of sister passage, chapter 7, verses 21 through 25, there's some really interesting things going on here. So first, you get this idea, you get this contrasting wisdom, and I'd love to know what you two have to say about this. There's this idea that on the one hand, there's the wisdom of God, which we see in verse 24. The wisdom of God, that which has been is far off and deep, very deep. Who can find this out? Basically, there is this wisdom that is this one type of wisdom that is something only God has. It's the wisdom that is ultimate. It's the nature of the universe. It's how the world is organized and works. And that wisdom, we do not have access to that wisdom. Only God has access to this particular kind of ultimate wisdom. But it seems that God does impart a certain kind of wisdom for human beings to know. Verse 25 in chapter 7. I turn my heart to know and search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. And so I think that by pairing chapter 7 and chapter 10 together, we really get some useful things. They're contrasting wisdom. God is one that cannot be known and is far off, but there is a kind of pragmatic wisdom that if we put our minds to it, if we practice intellectual acuity, if we practice this kind of thoughtfulness, presence of mind that Brad was talking about earlier, we can access this pragmatic wisdom. And that is, that's worth the energy, that's worth the work. But it is work. And it takes a kind of focus to persist in that. I don't know, what are your thoughts on those passages in kind of conversation with one another?
Yeah, I see that, you know, your reference of 24 and that kind of wisdom, this ultimate wisdom that only God has, is, you know, there's definitely a lot that man doesn't know that is mysterious and sort of esoteric to our experience. The questions that, you know, keep a lot of us up at night, like just wondering about and wrestling with. But you know, Jeremy, to speak towards that, like, pragmatic wisdom that's out there, yeah, that's sort of that applied knowledge of what is right. You know, there's, you know, you encounter all kinds of people out there who can tell you how you're doing something wrong, but when you ask for, like, the quality of, like, what they're doing that's better and how they're producing something, like, I'm doing some things to lose a lot of weight and get healthier, and I often come across lots of people who want to critique what I'm doing, and a lot of them are, ironically enough, heavier than I am. And I just, it makes you wonder, so you're not even applying this knowledge that you have. Is it any good to know? And I think that that's sort of the keystone to understanding what wisdom really is. It's this applied thing that is not just knowledge of what's right, but it is an applied thing that requires work and dedication to do it. It is, it's sort of evidential experience continued to be put into practice that's been proven correct and beneficial. And I see a lot of value to that.
I like that you highlight the, I don't know, I just keep going back to this idea that there's a practice here. There's a spiritual discipline that's present here. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's what I want to, I mean, John said it, so maybe I don't need to add to it. I just think it's worth underscoring the idea that having presence of mind, this sharp focus on what is in front of you, is that activity, that work, it is work. It's not our default position. And if we practice that acuity, our heart or mind, as Ecclesiastes chapter 10 says, is with us, and I think we're going to live a much wiser grounded life. And I think that to kind of pair that with chapter 7, there's this idea that, and we see it all the way through Ecclesiastes, we're always running into this. I thought that this wisdom was a kind of wisdom that was available to me. I thought this pragmatic wisdom was a wisdom that was for humans, and we run into limits all the time. Oh, wait, sure. But like, oh, I actually can't know this. Oh, my limit of knowledge is even, my knowledge is even more limited than I thought. So all the time we're running into these circumstances where we have, we see this really clear barrier on the limit to what we can know, what we can be wise about. But as far as I can tell, chapters 7 and 10 in Ecclesiastes suggest that the wise person lives in that frustration, and that the foolish person abandons the project. It's like, oh, forget it. And their mind is wandering, and their mind is absent.
I think you could probably have paired this with, you know, any choice of wisdom literature and kind of pulled some of the same context about the applied nature of wisdom and that kind of barrier that people come up against, you know, like when they're trying to find out the unfathomable. I'm reminded of Job, you know, God questioning Job and putting some, introducing the idea of sufficiency, that we've been given enough to handle and to deal with what's in front of us, even though we haven't been given everything. And it's just a matter of what we do with enough.
Yeah. I mean, it ties right into everything we're all saying. It's that the searcher, that seeker, that looking, you know, the 24 ends with that question, who can find it? And 25 starts with, it's chapter 7, you know, me. I turn my heart to know and to search out, to seek wisdom. And that is the present-minded person is always present. They're always looking, they're always seeking, they're paying attention. You know, where is what is where? I'm here, I am. There was some Dr. Seuss for you, but you know, it is that guy who is wisdom is the search for knowledge, the search for truth, and the absent-minded person's just blindly accepting, you know, why are you walking down that road? I'm, you know, because I'm walking on this road. That's verse 3 there in chapter 10, even the fool walks on the road. He just has a lack of sense. He's just, you know, here I am, not paying attention to anything. Did you see that? No. See what? You know.
Yeah, I get the idea that the opposite of your mental acuity, this indifference, ignorance, negligence, this not even paying attention to roads, to the path. Mm-hmm. There's definitely a lack of concern there about if there even is a right way to go.
Yeah, I want to, like, I mean, I think both of you were commenting on it, that the intellectual acuity thing, Brad, your comments on, like, the person who's just there, even the road that's already established, that, like, they may be, so to kind of drill into what you were saying there, Brad, the person who's going down this road, I think people, and I'm not trying to, I think that's kind of the warning. We don't want to be this sort of person. The people that maybe think they are living a life that is grounded in thoughtfulness and attentiveness are actually just kind of experiencing some dumb luck. They happen to be wandering on a road and things happen to be working out, basically, and therefore they chalk that up to wise living, when in fact it may be that society has set up certain parameters so that they're getting by, that their familial background has kind of set them up to have, you know, some success. And so I get this impression, and I don't know what your thoughts on this are, that it's just very interesting when Colette draws these really distinct categories. There's the wise man and there's the fool. It doesn't feel like there's a lot of vacillating between these two. And so I just see it as such a warning statement, right? You want to be the wise man, but it's kind of, there's a risk there because the fool is absent-minded. And you wonder if the fool is aware that you know, he's a fool.
The fool's not walking on the right road for the wrong reason. They're walking on the road, the right road, because they landed on it.
It's just, again, I see it more as a trajectory. I don't think you can suddenly, just by making one wise decision, be considered wise. Right. One foolish decision make you a fool. Certainly there are grave consequences to be from certain decisions, but I think we're looking more at a trajectory of decisions over time and how you can alter that trajectory to be more on the road, the right road, or err onto other, paths off the road. But I see those as sort of moments of decision that are made, and I think even the foolish person has those moments of clarity and opportunities to make a decision, to make a change where it's not entirely ignorance. I think that there are willful decisions made to be foolish.
Yeah, and I mean, right, mm-hmm. It should be said that I don't, as we're talking about, this wisdom statement or maxim, when I say, I like your commentary on this, if you have any on it, when I say practice intellectual acuity, you kind of develop intellectual acuity, right? It's a thoughtfulness or it's a sharpness of mind, but this is not a, I don't mean, and I don't know what your reading of this text is in this way. I don't really mean intelligence. I mean, we're not talking about like the ways that somebody's IQ separates one, it's not that your raw intelligence separates, the wise from the foolish or something. That's not what's being discussed here at all. So maybe it's worth elaborating on a little bit on what it then is to be the person, and I don't know, maybe the more practical we can be, the better here. What is it to be the person who is not absent of mind? How do we actually do that in a way that is allowing us to, not over the course of a week or a month or a season, but an entire life that is one that is sharp, where our minds are sharp and keen and focused, and where we're thoughtful. I mean, how do we do that in a way that allows us to be wise, to be aware of the road that we're on?
The crotchety old man in me wants to just say, just pay attention.
Maybe that's the point. It's very hard to like give like, okay, here are the five things that you do. I mean, it's really not that.
Right.
So could you elaborate on like, I mean, who do you, not by naming people, but like, I mean, you know, people that are paying attention, you know, people that are not. I mean, what is it that nudges people away from this focus of mind, this thoughtfulness of mind?
It is easier, I think about maybe to get like practical, maybe overly practical, like running through the woods or something and tripping. I was not being fully attentive there because I was just enjoying the ease of where I was at in that specific moment. And so maybe it's something along those lines of someone just is maybe genuinely happy and I like where I'm at right now, so let's keep this going, and wants to just lose themselves in that moment.
I think that there's a lot to be said about just reading further wisdom literature. I think reading through the Proverbs puts you in a state of mind of a lot of these simple axioms, a lot of things that are immediately applicable.
But not to interject too harshly there, John, but why are you reading the extra wisdom literature? Is it because someone told you to, or is it because you want to?
And what if you're talking about wanting to develop a wise state of mind, I think you have to be aware that there are limits to what a man can intuit on their own individually. And if somebody's done some of the work for us and it's been collected for us, why not take advantage of that resource? If you're talking about how to develop this in a vacuum and how to develop your conscience more, I think spending time in meditation to be aware, reflection, being practicing mindfulness, we've talked about in the past.
That's fair.
But all of those can be traced back really to, a lot of wisdom literature.
Yeah.
and different ways to practice that. So I think it would be a mistake to build a case for believers to seek wisdom without referencing a whole class of literature that's developed entirely to motivate and to spark the very same thing we're talking about.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's interesting to like, I mean, I John, I hear all that you're saying there, and I Brett, if I understand your question, part of what I think I hear, and again, John, I agree with what you're saying. What I hear in part is that probably the absent-minded person, the foolish person, as it's described in these wisdom texts, is probably not going to these wisdom texts. They're not choosing to look at them in the first place. And I think that it may be instructive to highlight that in wisdom literature, this use of the language heart mind, it seems to be quite interchangeable. And yeah, there's something there that is about, and again, I was trying to get away from, even though I use the language of intellectual acuity, I think that maybe can be a misleading phrase, even though I think the phrase is appropriate, but can be misleading, because what we're talking about is not the person who is who's the most well read or something. What we're talking about is the person who is listening to their conscience. They're actually tuned in to their own conscience, which has been redeemed through the Spirit of God, and they are not ignoring it, and they're not drifting away from. And I should add to that, they're letting their experiences, as they have experiences in their life, whether those experiences be very mundane or profound, they're allowing those experiences to speak to their own inner life and their own conscience. So I see this as that, to me, the minded person, the wise person is, and this is, I think, striking at what both of you are saying. I think that this is the person who is, they have a very clear path between their experiences and their inner life. There's this very clear kind of bi-directional relationship between what they're experiencing and how that is informing and guiding their own conscience and reforming their own inner life. And I think that that's something that when I think of people that I would describe as foolish, and when I think about seasons in my own life when I've been foolish, I have been ignoring, I've not been letting the experiences that God has sovereignly like put in front of me, I've not been letting those experiences shape my inner life. The intellectual acuity, the thoughtfulness, is about the bi-directional relationship between the experiences we're having and allowing those to actually inform our internal experience. And we have to believe that God is communicating to us through the experiences that are in front of us. Here's a quote from my bright abyss on this kind of intellectual acuity, this thoughtfulness, this focus. So here's Wyman. Unless we become aware of the transitions that are occurring all the time within us, unless we learn to let experience play upon our inner lives as on a finely tuned instrument, we will try to manufacture inner intensity from the outside. We will bang our very bones to roust our own souls. We will crave radical ruptures when we have allowed the nerves of our inner lives to go numb. But after those ruptures, the excitement or the tragedy, the pleasure or the pain, the mind returns to what it was. The soul quicksilvers off from the pierce of experience, and the kingdom of boredom, which could be the kingdom of God, begins to clock tick toward its next collapse. I mean, it goes on. It's actually this entire section is so excellent. But basically, I mean, what's being said here is that to essentially manufacture experiences of internal intensity. We seek to manufacture these experiences of like internal intensity by generating external excitements, whether they be good or bad. When in reality, you know, to go back to something that Brad was saying earlier, acuity of mind is accepting the experiences right in front of us and allowing those to shape our mind and conscience. I just think that's a sign of the wise person, the person who's dealing with the situation on the ground and asking, how is God shaping me in this? And the person who doesn't wear out in that, who keeps going in that.
Yeah, I think that gives us a lot, you know, definitely something to work towards. And I emphasize the word work because it's a conscious effort of building. It's not something that you accomplish in a day, but every day you build a little bit more towards this just by continuing engagement and just to continue to practice this seeking wisdom as you begin to build that between your experiential and internal life. That's really good.
Particularly, you know, look, I mean, we're in a really, this is such an unusual time that this is such an unusual time. I would imagine every living person in our country has not seen a time quite like this.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's the role of the mature Christian to not run from this experience, but to see that through this experience, God may be molding, reforming, shaping our inner lives, and that God can speak to our conscience through these sets of experiences that really none of us have had before. Yeah. And we're going to run into all kinds of limitations there. I mean, all the time we're running into these limitations where it's like, okay, that's something I can't know. That's like an ultimate wisdom. But to choose not to abandon the process of apprehending the wisdom God has for us. I think right now that's challenging. But I don't think we should shy away from it. I think that we are a community that is able to do that and grow from it. Brad, do you want to close us in prayer?
Lord, thanks for another wonderful Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, whatever day of the week it is in this strange quarantine world. Thanks that we all get to be together through the interwebs, pod world, however it is you say it nowadays. But it is pretty cool we can have this community and still do this. Yeah, help us all to pay attention. Be with us as we're all reading through this, contemplating, trying to figure out who the wise man is, how to be that guy. How to keep that dead fly from ruining our chalice of perfume throughout this next couple weeks. Be with us all, remind us all to be constantly communicating with each other through these strange times. Pray all this in your name, Lord. Amen.